Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we are thrilled to have you here. It's Friday morning. We're getting ready for a holiday weekend. I don't know about your commute may vary, but mine only took about 38 minutes. Usually takes about, how about you, Aaron? You come down the same road.
It's about 45 minutes for me.
Was it very quick?
It was quick.
Yeah, no traffic today.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of nice.
Yeah,
very nice.
It all happened this afternoon.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a holiday weekend, and we're getting ready. Just so you know, we'll be here on Monday because, you know, we just have too much fun.
Well,
we can't get out of it.
Point.
Yeah. Not that we didn't try. But anyway, we are very happy to be with you this morning, and we have a lot to talk about, so we'll get to that. Let me introduce the panel to you. First and foremost, Alan is off today. Alan is off, if you've been listening to the program this week. Alan has a new granddaughter, and he has gone to see the child and to spend time with his newest grandbaby. So we wish him well. So he's not with us this morning. So I roped Ray Graff into coming in and said, "Hey, Ray,
yeah.
Do you want to do the show with
sure.
me today?"
And he said, "Champing at the bit to be on the panel." So here I am. Also champing at the bit to leave. Ways to go.
It's a perfect day. And then we said, well, we have two more slots. What do we do? I know. We'll raid the faculty at Siena College. And we have done just that. Our new friend Aaron Pisidia is with us. He is a professor of economics, and he has been with us several times before. And it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much. And making her debut on the program this morning, we welcome Vera Acarias-Kelly, who is a professor of political science at Siena College. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you want for her cigarette?
Well, I mean, she's new.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right.
Calms the nerves.
All right.
I'm not nervous. How's that?
Well,
good
for you. No, that's good.
Well done.
Well, we still have
a long
we have 75 minutes to go. But no, that'll be fine. Welcome. It's very nice to see you and have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a lot of good political science questions to bring up over the next hour and a half, so we will start doing that. Let's start with the Trump tweet reaction. This was made shortly after we started the show yesterday. The president tweeting that about low IQ crazy Mika, meaning Mika Brzezinski, the co-host of MSNBC's Morning Joe, and Psycho Joe, who's known as Joe Scarborough, and then basically saying that they came on New Year's Eve and she was bleeding badly from a facelift, and he did not allow her and to come in and so forth. So the tweet has brought up a couple of points. One, doesn't he have anything better to do? That's one thing that it brought up. The other one is that it ended 5 months of relative silence from the president on the volatile issue of gender and reintroducing what many see as a political vulnerability, which is his history of demeaning women for their age, their appearance, and their mental capacity. Of why, when he seems to be upset with both Psycho Joe and low IQ Crazy Mika, that he tends to go more toward attacking the woman than he does in attacking Joe Scarborough. So, with that, I will put you, Vera, on the hot seat and see what you make of this.
Well, I have to say, it's repulsive that he tweets these kinds of misogynist messages. And I find it really disturbing to have somebody in the highest office of the land express such positions. While he's doing this sort of tweeting, he also, my voice is temporarily
going.
That's
all right.
Oh, here we go.
Want a lozenge?
Here we go. Yes, apparently that's what I need.
Yeah, not a cigarette, a lozenge.
Yeah, exactly. So he also expresses a lot of and signals a lot of hostility towards women, political women in political positions in other ways. For example, as you might know, I'm originally from Germany, and he expresses similar kinds of sentiments to Chancellor Angela Merkel. He's quite rude to her. He disrespects her. He sends messages all the time that undermine or attempt to undermine her position. That's a pattern. We see it in tweets in its most aggressive way. However, we now know for sure, prior to the election, after the election, and I think we can foresee that it'll never change, President Trump is a bully and a misogynist.
Right.
I commend everyone on all sides of the political spectrum to read, go to nationalreview.com and read David French, whose article says, Why Trump's Vengeful Tweeting Matters. And if you give me a moment here, I'll quote you just a little of this.
Oh, I will give you as many moments. In fact, you have 90 moments.
This is a fantastic piece. And he starts out, it's a sad symbol of our times that one feels compelled to actually make an argument why the president is wrong here. The pitiful reality is that there are people who feel like the man who sits in the seat once occupied by George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Dwight Eisenhower, and Ronald Reagan should use his bully pulpit for schoolyard insults and vicious personal attacks. But this is what we're reduced to. And so his argument is, first, it is simply and clearly morally wrong to attack another person like this. We have to get past the idea that another person's bad acts somehow justify our side's misconduct. Morality is not so situational. Trump is under a moral obligation to treat others the way he'd like to be treated, to love his neighbor as he would love himself. Second, it's not classist or elitist to make this moral argument. People of every social class and economic standing have the same moral responsibility, and our society suffers when we relax. Third, it is a misuse and abuse of the bully pulpit, all the more galling because it comes at a time when the positive parts of his agenda truly do need public champions. And then French ends up by saying, if there was ever a time for Republicans to show some backbone, to tell the president that some conduct is out of bounds, it is now. I think that's perfect. And that is from a fairly conservative magazine who really lets the president have it. And why some people will write in and say, well, stop talking about the tweets. And this explains exactly why it's important.
Yeah, I reject that argument too. I mean, we were touching about this yesterday, and it's important because, for all of the reasons that you mentioned, Ray, for all the reasons you mentioned, Vera, it seems to me that one of the things that keeps on coming up, and we saw this because I found even more disturbing. Okay. Maybe not more disturbing, but as disturbing, was the White House response to it of Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying, well, hey, look, you know, they were mean to him, so he has backbone, and so he can be mean to her. Well, okay. And then she said the line that is really starting to infuriate me, which is that, look, this president has been treated poorly and is being delegitimized left and right by the press. And no president has ever taken the slings and arrows that this president has taken. Well, first of all, I argue with that. But also, we have never seen a president like this. I mean, we can't. It's an apples and oranges comparison. We've never seen a situation like this. We've never had a president that has talked about a bleeding facelift before. I mean, this is so we can say that, oh, you're treating this guy worse than you've ever treated anyone else. Well, no one else has treated anyone else as bad as he's been treating other people.
This started during the campaign. This is not a one-off incident. So this is just, you know, a pattern of this. And I think the larger issue here is that when, you know, the president of the United States acts in such an undignified manner that it largely legitimates the lack of civility that's going to happen in normal everyday conversations. Like, it really just debases the civility we have with our neighbors, and that if you disagree with somebody, you call them, you know, bleeding from a facelift or the most egregious insult you can think of. And that's bad. And you see it in congressional discourse, too, where, you know, people are just yelling at each other instead of talking about actual policy issues.
There is an op-ed in the Washington Post written by both Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. They were also on their own program this morning. They were supposed to be on vacation, and smartly they thought, oh, this would probably be good ratings. So
I believe you are correct, sir.
They went on. I know I tuned
Bring
in.
It on.
I tuned in at 6 o'clock going, where are they? I want to see Willie Geist. And then they said, oh, they'll be on at 7. So, right, I'm there. They authored this op-ed for the Washington Post writing, President Trump launched personal attacks against us Thursday, but our concerns about his unmoored behavior go far beyond the personal. America's leaders and allies are asking themselves yet again whether this man is fit to be president. We have our doubts, but we are both certain that the man is not mentally equipped to continue watching our show, Morning Joe. This has been something, apparently, from what the version of the story that Morning Joe and Mika and Joe Scarborough are saying is that this came as a response to some joking that Mika was doing on the program in regards to the Time Magazine story, that the covers of the Time Magazine that were throughout Mar-a-Lago were fake, that he kind of, they were fake and they put him up. So, but is that, I'm going back to the White House response. If somebody says something about that and makes fun of it, well, does that even dignify a response from the President of the United States?
It's just all around disturbing when I think about the fact that we have a G20 meeting coming up. We don't have a Russia policy. We don't seem to have clarity on how to address Iraq post-ISIS. We do not have a clear policy on Syria. We do not have good relations with our allies. I find it disturbing to think about the White House's response to particular TV shows, particular individuals, the press secretary's response to how to respond to a tweet.
Do you think the point of this is to distract from a completely imploding agenda? The healthcare bill vote that was delayed, the lack of any type of progress on his infrastructure project or tax reform. I mean, this seems just to distract from his failings as a politician as well, like you said, with foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that overall, what we now have is a president who, whenever he realizes he's not getting positive press, he seems to redirect. He's worried about his upcoming international trip. His last international trip did not go well, except for his bizarre visit in Saudi Arabia, one of the most repressive regimes in the world. He apparently gets along well with the Saudi elites. But otherwise, he was not impressive on the road. And so he's nervous about this trip. He doesn't have clarity. He lacks historical and political knowledge about a number of those countries. And so, in fact, he seems to redirect.
How do you know he's nervous, though?
Well, because of his interactions with, he basically promises things, makes policy that will never be implemented or addresses issues. He just seems to talk without preparation. So maybe he's not nervous. Maybe he just does what he does or what he did as a TV show host.
Maybe lacking
makes things up.
Making a lacking a command of or at very least not following through in a way that we have seen with past leaders as they get ready for such trips. I do want to just talk about how this story has been advanced in the last 20 minutes, which is that both Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough levied a charge, both in their op-ed but on MSNBC this morning, saying that the White House threatened a negative tabloid story about them unless they asked Trump, who is friendly with the National Enquirer's publisher David Pecker, to have the story killed. This year, top White House staff members warned that the National Enquirer was planning to publish a negative article about us unless we begged the president to have the story spiked. They wrote, "We ignored their desperate pleas." And so Trump then took to Twitter at 9 855 this morning and said, watch low-rated Morning Joe for the first time in a long time. Fake news. He called me to stop a National Enquirer story. I said no. Bad show. Joe Scarborough tweeted back at 903 and said, why do you keep lying about things that are so easily disproven? What is wrong with you? So the story goes on. The story goes on. Yet another lie. I have texts from your top aides and phone records. Also, those records show I haven't spoken with you in many months. This is from Joe Scarborough, who again wrote this today. So where I'm interested in the fact that, because I know people are, we saw this yesterday, people write in and say, well, this is all a diversion. This is being thrown at us because of the travel ban goes into effect, went into effect yesterday. We're getting, we're much of what Vera said, that we're this is being thrown at us because there isn't a strong policy in what's going on in the upcoming G20. There isn't, the health plan is in serious jeopardy. So that this is a diversion, but it's also, I mean, it does show, I think, behavior that is concerning, that deserves to be talked about. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be nice to say we have a noble, honest, dignified president, and we don't. So yeah, this is, like I said, this is going to leak into ordinary everyday discourse where people just become.
What do you mean going to?
It's going to exacerbate it.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. Ray Graff. We also have Aaron Pasitti with us and Vera Carias-Kelly. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the... singing along? Is that what
yeah.
You're
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow, I love that. I love when we make... Are you,
Ida, sweet as apple cider. I don't know which one that one is.
If I didn't know
sweet
you better,
I
would think you were happy.
Really?
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Welcome back to our panel discussion this morning. We have some letters. We welcome your letters. We're talking about the tweets of the president yesterday regarding the Morning Joe hosts, Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, and we will move on and talk about other topics in a little bit, but let's see what the mailbag has. We begin by a note from our former panelist and dear friend of our program, Rosemary Armeo, who, as we know, is overseas doing great work with for young journalists and just wonderful work throughout the world. And she said, hey, I just want to say, please do not pay attention to listeners warning you that the Trump's tweets about Mika are a distraction from the lousy China trade policy he is making. Steel and banking are important, yes, but so is our president's irrational and ugly views on women. Does his bizarro obsession with bleeding women have any connection to his anti-Planned Parenthood campaign? Even if that's a stretch, his tweets about women's appearances are proof of ugly sexism in our culture. That is not a distraction. It's a problem to be faced. And to prove that this message is from Rosemary, she says, by the way, if it was a facelift, she looks great and I want one too.
That's Rosemary for you.
By the way, Mika said on this morning, she said, yes, I had a little waddle and I got rid of it. And I think it looks great. So good on her. Good for her. All right. Carol writes, wonderful, there is an economist on the panel. That would be you, Aaron.
Thanks.
All right. Please tell us what the economic repercussions could be if the U.S. follows up the recent sanction on a Chinese bank to punish North Korea with further sanctions on the Chinese.
What the economic implications for the U.S. are, or?
Yes. I mean, could be if the U.S. Yes, the repercussions for the U.S.
Minimal. Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at one bank, that's not going to have a major effect on U.S. Economic policy or outcomes.
Aaron says, another Aaron from Rensselaer says, can we impeach this man-child fool for nothing other than speech and actions and becoming the office of the office of the president? Enough already. Bobby says people are realizing that Trump's tweets are turning more and more Americans off. They wish he would stop tweeting and get on with business. But when will they realize, whether he tweets or not, that this is who they elected? This is who he is. He's not going to stop being himself. He has no moral center to guide him. I think it's a good reminder of what needs to be changed, the White House resident and his West Wing apologists. Steve says Trump no longer can surprise us. He can only continually shock us. That's a great point.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we are almost prepared when the next tweet comes in terms of what it will say. It will be offensive. It will be disturbing, undignified. And yes, will we be surprised next time? Probably not. And also, I'm worried about young people starting to tune out, because as college professors, Aaron and I see it, students are not engaged when these kinds of things happen. They actually think that politics is broken. And I think that's a real danger for the future of democracy in this country.
I mean, was there a time when a majority of the students were really tuned in?
In my experience, yes. Especially at the beginning of the Obama administration, the first administration, students were very engaged. They thought about getting involved in community activism. They felt inspired to change their communities.
You know, yeah, so engaged, but also at minimum, just less cynical about politics in general.
We got this from Paul, who says, while the outrage over the POTUS tweet regarding Morning Joe host Mika Brzezinski continues in the news media, he once again creates a misdirection, and we take our eye off the target by focusing all the attention to the tweet. The real important issues facing us are put in place right under our nose. We need to continue to address issues such as the Russian investigation, the possible collusion, the elimination of environmental laws, thereby opening up our shoreline to offshore drilling. He's winning because his tweets fill the social news media and he fulfills his promises. I feel bad for all that they are abused by his words and tweets, but we cannot let him point us away from our direction with these actions. We must keep focused and stop him from causing the greater harm than that of a tweet. And again, that was what we were saying, I think, early on in the program. Actually, that was written before we started the show. But yeah, I mean, there are certainly, I don't think anyone on this panel, and certainly most of our listeners, I think, agree with that there are far bigger issues than the president's tweets. However, you know, you look at the wide range of issues, and this is certainly one of them that is greatly concerning, especially considering the person who is making some of the decisions, many of the decisions that are addressing these issues, is worried about other things.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if I get mad at somebody, you know, you can process it and say that you disagree, but the degree to which he's being explicit about this signifies a very unstable mental equilibrium.
All right, let's move on to other subjects and talk about other stuff, including the health bill. And where are we now? So when last we left the health bill, the Republicans said that they were going to try to get at least this all together so that they could put a new plan in front of the Congressional Budget Office. Now, projected Medicaid spending under a Senate Republican bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act would be 35% lower after two decades, according to the Congressional Budget Office in their new report on Thursday, which detailed how Medicaid changes would cut more deeply as they go fully into force. The Budget Office analysis created a fresh challenge for Republican leaders as they tried to muster support for their bill, even as senators scattered to their home states for a 10-day July 4th recess. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky entertained a stream of senators on Thursday trying to reach agreement on the contents of a revised bill. But by the end of Thursday, McConnell's caucus still appeared far from a consensus, and it was unclear when a new version of the bill would be ready. The nonpartisan budget office had already said that the bill would cut projected Medicaid spending 26% in 2026. Quote, a large gap would grow between Medicaid spending under current law and under this bill, the new report said. And the gap would widen so that federal Medicaid spending in 2036 would be more than a third lower under the bill than under the Affordable Care Act.
So there's two ways to look at this. There's one, the first, the big picture is like, this is not a policy. This is not how legislators should craft major pieces of legislation. you know, Republicans weren't serious about crafting the policy. They weren't consulting experts. Every major health and doctors organization says this is a bad policy. Republicans aren't serious about implementing good social policy. So that's the bigger issue. But in terms of like the nuts and bolts of this plan, you know, 20% of the population relies on Medicare to some extent. So that's like 75 million people. Half of that are children. Then you have another 11 million who are disabled or poor, 7 million of the elderly, people who have opioid addictions. So this is just savage and cruel in that they're cutting the main source of funding for, you know, low income and old age healthcare. And this is going to just lead to an absolute death spiral if it gets passed. This is
barbaric. What are the chances of that, do you think, right now?
I can't imagine it's going to get passed. There are intelligent Republicans who see that the Medicaid expansion and Obamacare is actually working in their states, and they might not philosophically agree with it, but it's working. And if they pass it, they know that their seat might be in jeopardy.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, on another point, right now, what they're doing is horse trading, right? The different parts of the party are looking for different kinds of additions or subtractions to this bill, but it's a very narrow path to passing this legislation. So I don't really foresee it either, especially since the senators are going home now and they will have to face their constituencies unless they bunker up in their homes and don't speak with people. But I believe there will be some time to reflect now among all of these Republicans to think about what the future will look like for them and their states if, in fact, they pass this legislation. So I have my doubts.
Right? No? Okay. I'm. Go ahead, Aaron.
So one of the big Republican criticisms of Obamacare is that it's in collapse. It's in this death spiral. And that's pretty Orwellian, because if you look at the Republican plan, that this is exactly what's going to lead to the death spiral. You get rid of the you raise costs by reducing Medicare funding, which mm-hmm. makes health insurance more expensive for people. Since they're cutting subsidies and, you know, switching with tax credits, insurance is going to become more costly for more people. So, of course,
which it already is,
which
and
it
has.
Sure, correct. But this is going to make it more expensive than what exists under the American or the Affordable Care Act. So that's going to lead to fewer people buying insurance, and the people who are not going to buy insurance because it's too expensive are going to wait until they get sick, then buy the insurance, and that's going to raise costs further, which is going to mean less people buy it in the future, and you're going to get the death spiral that Republicans said the Affordable Care Act is producing, which it hasn't been. There are some problems with it, but what congressional Republicans are doing is creating the death spiral of having less people insured, making insurance more expensive, and just it's not a health care bill either. It's a tax cut for the wealthy that's masquerading as a health care bill. So,
yeah, in addition to that, I think we have to look at the quality of the types of insurance that might be offered. So I'm somebody who is, I have advanced cancer. And so this is an issue that I'm really, really concerned about. Can you imagine you buy a very slim plan and all of a sudden you're diagnosed with a condition that is extremely expensive and will last for the rest of your life? A slim plan will not cover those expenses. And if you're not independently wealthy or have relatives with financial security, what does your future hold? It's depressing and disturbing.
And one of the main advantages of the Affordable Care Act was that it specified what the essential health benefits were, so that you didn't go through a process of, you know, extensive care and then find out at the end, oh, my insurance company doesn't cover this.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're, you know, left with these huge bills. That was what the Affordable Care Act did, to specify what the essential benefits were and how much was going to be covered.
But it still didn't do the job for a vast majority of the people in this country. In other words, we have a good plan here. And if I have to go into the hospital, that's $1,000 out right now. You tell me there aren't tens of millions of people who aren't going to be able to pony up $1,000, even if they're on a good plan. There's a real problem. And clearly, whatever the Republicans do still doesn't take away from the fact that the ACA has not done that job.
Correct. I mean, the ACA was a policy that came out of the very conservative Heritage Foundation in the early 90s as a response to the Clinton administration's initial foray into healthcare. And, you know, you have a conservative plan, which is, the Affordable Care Act, which was Romney Care in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Implemented by a Democratic president, and Republicans are saying this isn't conservative enough, which is just mind-boggling. And the solution is single-payer health care. It's cheaper, it's administratively easier to accomplish, and it just gets rid of all of these problems and can allow the country to focus on more substantive issues.
And when you think about it, I don't understand, and this is an international perspective once again, why it is that in the United States this idea exists that you have to reinvent healthcare when we have fully functioning, effective healthcare systems in other countries that could simply be copied and perhaps improved upon. Why come up with a new plan? It doesn't seem to make sense to me. We have single-payer systems in various European countries, in addition to the option to buy into added private insurance, so you can add multiple layers depending on how much you want to invest or what possible inherited diseases you might have in your family. So there are lots and lots of options that are more affordable. And we know, based on the track record, that those insurance plans are cheaper than what we currently have in the United States.
And give better health outcomes.
And that on top of it.
Longer life expectancy. And
much lower numbers in infant deaths. And there are all these rumors out there that, for example, you have to wait many, many weeks to actually get an appointment, which is not true. It's just a myth. So for any necessary surgery, for example, you get scheduled right away. Now, elective surgeries might take you a few months, but then what's different about that right now here? So I don't know. I think we need to just simply look at existent plans in the world that work very well and maybe start over, because the current process, I don't think, is helpful to the American public.
Let's go ahead.
I did a back of the envelope calculation that if given the relationship between healthcare spending and life expectancy in the rest of the world. No, I already did. If you look at the relationship between healthcare spending and life expectancy in the rest of the world, given what the U.S. spends on health care costs, which is one out of every $6, the average American should live to be 120.
I don't want that.
Yeah.
I don't want it either, but that's the point, is that we're spending way too much and getting way too little.
Okay. Ray's trying to do everything in his power to
prevent 120 is out of line.
It's a metaphor.
Unless
Ray.
Your name is Shartok, that's not an option you want.
On that note, let's take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. You know, every once in a while people say to us, I sent a letter in and it's not read on the air. Why is that the case?
Yeah, why?
And because, you are putting your thumb on me. You're not letting me express my outrage as to what you're saying. Well, here's the thing. Sometimes your letters are really long. So we ask you to do the following things. Keep your listeners keep your letters short and to the point. Don't include links. We can't click them on the air, and quite frankly, we're not going to. So,
unless they look saucy, and then we will, obviously. Yeah.
Saucy. Yes, saucy.
Yeah.
And don't use abbreviations and proofread your emails before you send them. If you can't read it on the way back, then obviously we don't know what you intended to say. And then we kind of make it up, and that's not fair either. So just a little guidance as we go through this process this morning. With that in mind, we go to the letters that we have. Louise says, the members of Congress that want to repeal the ACA should all walk a mile in the shoes of their constituents that need the services that they want to take away. Let them decide if they should buy food or pay the power bill.
Louise is right.
Martha writes, question, we hear a lot about how Obamacare definitely is not perfect, needs to be fixed. Is there anybody offering some solutions to that? Democrats?
Bernie Sanders did.
No, it didn't go well.
No, it didn't go well, but that's
we're hoping that's that'll be next.
Bipartisanship and
yeah,
some
that would be helpful, I think. I mean, that's what people want.
I think they make a mistake in putting this timetable on it.
Oh.
Like before July 4th or whatever. Just get it done. Take your time. Right. Do it right. Let's not redo it in 2 years, all right?
Leslie says, I would like to give a thoughtful response to these latest inappropriate tweets, but I'm running out of words. Trump is putting us in great peril by his unwillingness to learn the job, much less do the job. So many positions are unfilled, and those that are mostly have people who are vastly lacking in proper qualifications. He has made a mockery of the office he holds, and by extension, of us as a country. Catherine says, I'm worried about what's happening behind the scenes. The zombie effect that you talked about, the arm twisting and tweaking of the health care bill to lure dissenting Republican senators with deceptive promises. Yeah, the backroom deals have to be interesting, right?
But they've
right?
been going on forever on in every
right.
deal, ever
yeah.
cut.
There's nothing new. It's there, just
yeah, and whatever you give
time.
To the right wing of the Republicans, then a couple of the more moderate senators might pull out. So one can only assume there this goes back and forth now and will not result in a legislative outcome.
Leon writes, waiting for Calvinist educator-in-chief Betsy DeVos to speak out on the impact and educational value to our children of our president's demeaning, retaliatory, repulsive, bullying, vengeful, mean tweets.
Wow, it's like Mad Libs. Good job.
Yeah, I know. Impressive.
Mike says, I have officiated high school baseball for more than 40 years. It took my first two seasons to realize that having my judgment questioned was not an attack on my integrity. I had to develop a thick skin. A thicker skin would benefit Donald Trump. The question is, will he learn?
That's great. And umpires have to take – we were abusing the umpire last night at my son's game. He made some terrible calls.
Well, you weren't.
Well, we let him know that he made a mistake, but we liked him personally.
Yeah, that's good.
Even though he was a terrible lump.
Catherine writes, people prefer believing Trump's tweets, et cetera, are a diversion as this would indicate that he's not really like this, that this is a considered strategy. Instead, we may need to consider that he's not well. And then, what are we to do?
Well, we decided during the break that his pattern might be that he is a compulsive person who can't control his utterances or his tweets. So maybe there's something to that.
Take away the device.
It's like a 13-year-old who got in trouble. You take away their TV privileges, take away their smartphone privileges, and time out.
I can't believe we have that conversation about the president of the United States.
But many people made the point yesterday, and I think it's worth making again, that And Ray, I speak to you as a father of, but you know you wouldn't if in many cases even for employers if an employee did this, they would be reprimanded. If you were a parent and somebody bullied somebody, and I think that's certainly what it is, bullying.
Yeah.
You would take away their device. I mean it is.
Yeah. I mean you should see my son's tweets about Mika Brzezinski. They're awful.
By the way, did you just notice, Ray, that our mic stands are
Mika.
Are Mika brand?
Sure.
Did you know that?
Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
It's kind of neat. Yeah, I didn't know that until I was just.
But you know, coming back to the point of business leaders, for example, which leader, manager in a corporation or CEO would be able to get away with such tweets? The boards would dismiss them. They'd be fired. That you know, I mean, this is just.
And yet he is a CEO.
And yet he is a CEO. And yet he is the president.
Don't you think it's just the times they are a-changing? And society now, nobody listens. Everybody talks. If everybody did a little listening, I think we're all in a better place.
Well, I think we're listening to this. I think. Don't you think the lion's share of people are listening to what's being done right here?
I think everyone as a person needs to listen.
Yes.
And talk less and listen more. It's terrible to say on a panel where all we do is talk, but if everybody in the world listened a little bit and just shut up, everything will be a lot better.
Well, I mean,
as radio hosts, we want people to listen more.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, but I think it does make sense to inquire about if, you know, an opponent's position. You know, if you want to have insights into why somebody else has a different argument related to healthcare, related to taxes, it makes sense to actually try to achieve to understand what their main arguments are, because you could then decide whether you agree or disagree and perhaps discuss your ideological or fundamental philosophical differences. What we're not doing is listening to each other and figuring out why it is that somebody has a particular position. So we do have to be more thoughtful, inquiring, and we have to discuss rather than shout and debate and tune out.
And stop the name calling and personal insults with people you disagree with.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll conclude our program and do our last break. We're going to get a news update from Jim Lavulis and hear a couple messages. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. 6 minutes past 10 o'clock on this Friday morning, and it's the 30th of June. We thank you for being with us. Panel at WAMC.org for your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Joining us for the discussion this morning, we're lucky enough to have WAMC's Ray Graff with us. Good morning, Ray.
Hi, boys and girls.
For the first time, and wowing us all, Vera Acarius-Kelly is here, professor of political science at Siena College. Thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
You having fun?
I have lots of thoughts.
Are you having fun?
Oh, am I having fun? Of course.
Okay.
Can you say something in German for us?
Natürlich kann ich das. Das ist meine Heimatsprache.
Oh, that's great.
Do you know what she said, right?
No, but it sounds great.
It does, right?
And as if, because it was my father's alma mater, we are rating the faculty at Siena College today. Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pacitti, here as well. Good morning. How are you? Are you having fun?
I am having a blast.
You know, this is the first time you're getting ready. You're going on vacation, so you're like here and then going on vacation. So this is the first time you've been here where we've noticed how much ink you have on you.
Yeah,
you're a heavily tattooed
Starbelly Sneech.
Look at that. There's an adage that says only trust economists with tattoos.
Who has that added? You?
Me.
Yeah.
Karl Marx and you, apparently.
Yeah. Right. So we have stars on the right arm, and then on the left arm is
water and cherry blossoms.
Oh, very cool.
Good for you.
Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Nice.
Very good.
Huh?
Is there anything in between?
His torso.
Not in my head. Yeah, my torso.
Okay. Help me out here, Ray.
Not a chance.
You're not going to help me ask
this
question?
Maybe. I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay. Are the tattoos you have visible right now, or are there others?
There are a few others.
Okay, there you go. All right. What?
Do you care?
No, I thought it was interesting.
Do you want me to take my shirt off?
No. God, no.
Really?
Please, God, no.
Please, let's not go there, guys.
I was just curious. I mean, probably, what do you think? The most tattooed member of the panel, Mike Spain, right? Probably? Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, Chartok's got the Pete Seeger tattoo on his chest, and we know about that one.
Yeah, I think that's a banjo. All right. Oh. Let's go on to the letters. Samantha says, Ray, I agree. $1,000 out of the pocket is a tough nut to crack, but let's face it, most people can scrape together the cash for an expensive car repair when needed. Here's the thing. Those plans may cost you several thousand in deductibles in a year, but if you get really, really sick, you're protected from going bankrupt. You won't be making a choice between treating your cancer and putting your family on the street. Shana says, good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Do you think the people who have been screaming for the ACA to be replaced are seeing that the Republican health care bill will be more detrimental?
Absolutely. What, detrimental to the health care system?
Do you think the people who have been screaming for the ACA to be repealed are seeing that the Republican healthcare plan would be worse than what we have now?
I think that's starting to come to the public's starting to realize this in general.
Yeah, for sure.
Larry, so this is for you, Veris, is the reason we can't mimic European healthcare plans is they don't have insurance companies demanding a piece of the action. Their place at the table was guaranteed when Tom Daschle, on behalf of the insurance industry, handpicked a candidate to counter Clinton's plan for a single payer, Barack Obama.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying we have models out there. And you're right. We would have to start over.
I don't think we'd have to start over. We could have, you know, Medicaid for all,
yes.
And then just gradually reduce the power of the insurance industry. And I think that would largely happen naturally if you had Medicaid for all. I don't think we need to start over.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is the structure we have in place is ideologically propped up by, one party. And so, if not members of the other party as well. So we have a very difficult time imagining Medicaid for all.
Let me ask our tattooed economist this question. Would you predict that X number of years down the road, this country is single payer?
Yes.
And, how long?
2049.
Interesting.
That's a totally arbitrary number. But, I think that in all seriousness, the reason for that is the amount employers pay for their employees' health care is becoming an increasing burden as health care costs go up. We've got an aging population, so the baby boomers are starting to retire, and it's going to be a crushing burden to private businesses. It's a crushing burden to the government, and either, we implode or figure out a better way to deal with it.
So how do you then deal with all of the insurance companies who will want their pound of flesh on the way out the door?
Firing squads.
Well, the email address is panel@wamc.org.
It's the tattoos talking.
Susan says, so agree with your new panel member regarding not reinventing healthcare, rather take a look at what works in other countries. Been saying this for years. Bob says, I agree with your guest regarding the myth of waiting for surgeries and operations in countries with single payer and how our system doesn't have that defect. I have to wait at least 2 months to see my GP, specialist 3 months or more. That's a great point.
It is
a great point.
Yeah.
Also, from Harriet, Ray.
Yes.
You're such a gem.
Oh, really?
Your subtle humor is priceless. A good belly laugh is a wonderful way to start one's day.
Print that. Send it to Shartok right now.
There you go.
We're going to get us a raise. Harriet, thank you very much.
Let's move on to other topics, and we'll frame that for Ray.
Yeah, there's one.
Let's move on to other things, and as soon as I can bring them up on my computer, I promise you I will do that. What do you got in front of you there, Ray?
Our president will be apparently meeting face-to-face with Vlad at the G20 on the sidelines, as it is. And so it's said that pragmatism will prevail. That's the hope of Sergey Lavrov. And we shall see. Is there any pragmatism to be had on either side? We'll find out.
It will meet. This was announced yesterday. The National Security Advisor said on Thursday that this highly anticipated talks amid escalating tensions over Moscow's interference in the 2016 election and a series of inquiries into whether President Trump and his associates colluded with Russia. The White House would not say whether Mr. Trump plans to press Mr. Putin on the issue of Russia's meddling in last year's election, a topic the president has avoided talking about despite deep concern inside his own administration and on Capitol Hill. The meeting, the first between the two since Mr. Trump took office, will occur on the sidelines of the Group of 20 Economic Summit meeting in Hamburg, Germany, providing a dramatic focal point for Mr. Trump's second international trip as he faces deep skepticism on the world stage. So, Vera, let's talk about this because you touched on this early on in our discussion about the first trip. Maybe it didn't go well. So how do you then look at this one?
Well, I think it'll be a disappointment. I already know it will be a disappointment because he's arriving with this sort of negative energy around him related to his environmental policies. Angela Merkel has sort of focused on the issue that the Europeans need to get together and focus on moving the agenda forward, protecting the environment. And he will be looking a bit like an outcast arriving at the G20 meeting for that reason alone. In addition to that, his erratic behavior, his tweeting, his need to be at the center of attention. The Europeans are very concerned about Vladimir Putin's influence in Ukraine, his you know, his involvement in sort of the cybersecurity issues, undermining stability in Ukraine continuously. The Europeans are very concerned, and I don't think President Trump has any chance for improving his reputation in this upcoming G20 meeting.
We are obviously talking about the meeting with Vladimir Putin, but the other story to come out of the preparations for the summit is that the chancellor of your home country is ready for a fight.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is, because her election is coming up. She's running for her fourth re-election in September. She is well positioned to be re-elected, and President Trump is so profoundly unpopular in Germany that for her it is ideal to position herself as a critic of President Trump. So we know the encounter between President Trump and Angela Merkel, Chancellor Merkel, will be a piece of theater.
I think the kind of poetic justice here is that Trump, who, you know, brands himself as a, you know, great negotiator and, you know, just has good reads on business situations, is getting played so hard by Putin. Putin knows how to stroke Trump in ways that make him more malleable. And, man, Trump is getting played
by
Putin.
We'll see. I think that there is a certain amount on the left of, gosh, we hope he fails. And really, you don't know until he goes to the meeting whether it's going to be a disappointment and what agreements come out of it. Yes, we know that most of the world is not happy about the pulling out of the Paris Agreement. However, you can't judge a meeting in advance of the meeting and also in advance of things that may come out of that meeting. So you can't tell until afterwards whether it is a success.
True, but Trump's been getting played by Putin for a while in terms of his, you know, even though there's been no Russia policy, you know, economically or with respect to foreign policy. But, you know, I think he's falling right into Putin's hands about, you know, you lift the sanctions, the oligarchs' money will keep flowing to your business interests. And maybe that's not getting played. Maybe that's just a quid pro quo. So, yeah, you're right. We won't know what happened, but it'll be interesting to see.
Well, I think one of the issues, too, is that we know that from our last meeting between President Trump and Chancellor Merkel was that President Trump did not understand that he could not negotiate deals with European countries on a one-country-by-one-country basis. He did not understand how the European Union works, and he criticized Germany for its overly effective car sales in this country, which, you know, I'm not quite sure what to say to that, but capitalism apparently is only supposed to work within the United States, but not globally. So, I mean, the setup really is for disputes on all kinds of levels. And if we measure success of an international trip based on actual outcomes, it doesn't look promising because Chancellor Merkel is running for re-election. She's positioning herself as the leader of European countries on environmental issues, on global economic issues. And really, President Trump has not figured out that she would be an important go-to person to advance his own agenda. And so as long as he doesn't step into that sort of relationship, I foresee very little positive outcome from this meeting. And that's, I guess, how I would explain my position that I don't believe this will be a good experience for President Trump.
So how do we get beyond that? I mean, because it seems that we have that working with the rest of the world on so many issues that we seem to be creating more problems than we're solving initially. And I guess my question is, how do we get over that long term if we're still causing damage down the road? You know what I mean? It's like if we don't correct ourselves now, it's only going to get worse. So then how do we try to buffer this?
I don't know. We've had bad policies for a long time with the rest of the world. You know, at different parts at different times.
Yes.
But this is, you know, an American legacy of meddling and bad policy and difficult situations created. So I don't know.
Well, it's somber.
Revolution.
Yeah.
Revolution? I don't know.
Revolution.
Well, I mean, but the policies now may not be as effective. I mean, internationally, the State Department has been gutted. The budget is, slashed. But most importantly, we don't have empowered ambassadors internationally. And below the ambassadorial levels, a lot of positions have not been filled. The State Department is a structure on which a president must rely for international policy. But since there is no clear policy, for example, to Russia, right, we don't even know how we will address the future changes in Syria. Syria might be split up into multiple countries. So what are the Russians saying about that? Do we know? The Russians certainly have a policy towards Syria, but our policy is not very clear. The military currently runs our foreign policy, right, not the State Department. And so we have a splintering effect, which makes the position of the United States less influential, less cohesive, and in the long run, quite problematic, especially if you don't work with allies.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and I just want to get to our final story, which is one I will admit, Vera, I picked with you in mind, with your political science background. I had not heard about this at all until I saw this article in the Washington Post yesterday, that the chair of President Trump's Election Integrity Commission has penned a letter to all 50 states requesting their full voter roll data, including the name, address, date of birth, party affiliation, last four Social Security number digits, and voting history back to 2006 of potentially every voter in the state. In the letter, a copy of which was made public by the Connecticut Secretary of State, the commission head, Chris Kobach, said that, quote, any documents that are submitted to the full commission will also be made available to the public. On Wednesday, the office of Vice President Pence released a statement saying a letter will be sent today to the 50 states of and District of Columbia on behalf of the commission requesting publicly available data from state voter rolls and feedback on how to improve election integrity. States have already started to react to this. The governor of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, said, I have no intention of honoring this request. Virginia conducts fair, honest, and democratic elections. There's no evidence of significant voter fraud in Virginia. Connecticut Secretary of State Denise Merrill, said she would share publicly available information with the Kobach Commission while ensuring that the privacy of voters is honored by withholding protected data.
I mean, you know, when you look at this, this is intimidating. This is threatening to fundamental principles to democracy.
It's also interesting to see how now all of a sudden big government is okay and the idea of states' rights is just thrown out the door. The government's going to mandate this.
Most of this information is already publicly available, however, correct?
Correct.
So a lot of this is political grandstanding?
Can you reveal how people voted? I mean, is that public information? Could somebody look up how I voted?
No, I don't think that you're going to get that information.
No, but I find it interesting that they want voter rolls with Social Security numbers, and then they might find who's registered for what party. And
which I think
they
you
begin
can do.
You can, but you don't get the data sets automatically provided by the state. So it would make that process of linking those kinds of data points much more, it would simplify it, which would give access to such information. I don't know. I'm in favor of protecting such data because we don't know what in the future connected linked metadata is used for.
What you could do with this.
What you could do with it, right? What else do you link it to in the future?
Well, unless you use it to hack the election.
Well, okay, well, I mean, you know.
But on that happy note, we're all done.
Are you saying somebody will send it off to Russia?
You know, I don't know what I'm saying.
I think what
he's saying
is Afid is angry.
We're out of time. My thanks to the panel. Ray, thank you very much for gracing us with your presence. Vera Karius-Kelly, thank you for being for making your debut. What a delight.
Thanks.
I hope you'll come back with us. And Aaron Pacitti, have a great holiday.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Enjoy the weekend. We'll be back with more show after this.